You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And the theme of today's programme, it's fictionalising the lives of others, really. Our studio guest is Jill Dawson, talking about her new novel, The Language of Birds, based on the Lord Lucan scandal. We'll also hear from Whitney Shara. She's talking about her debut novel, The Age of Light, about the photographer Lee Miller. And Kay Blaney will be chatting to us about dramatising the lives of Cambridge folk in the Mill Road monologues. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Jill.
Thank you.
Lovely to have you here. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But as I say, fictionalising the lives of others is a theme really of today's programme. It's something you've done before, the real lives of others, Rupert Brooke, Patricia Highsmith, Fred and Edie.
Yes, I seem to make a habit of it. I don't know quite why, but there's something about a narrative that's already there, that's been told by others, and investigating that strikes me as really interesting.
And why those people in particular?
I don't know why the people come to me, because in fact they're very different, obviously. I mean, Rupert Brooke, a local figure, but not necessarily the others. It has to be something that obsesses me, because it takes so long to work on a novel and then to, you know, sort of for the book to exist and still talk about the novel. You have to remain really interested in the subject. So I think I wait till someone gets hold of me in that way.
And when you're researching, do you often find, I mean, it's an old adage, but do you find the truth is stranger than fiction?
Endlessly. And in fact, I prefer it. If there's a fact, I don't necessarily want to change it. I know that's the prerogative of fiction. We make things up. But for me, sometimes looking at something and looking again and again is what's interesting. Revisiting a small detail interests me a lot more than inventing plot of my own.
And for people like Rupert Brooke and Patricia Highsmith, they've got legions of fans and followers. Are you aware of those when you're writing?
Well, I've already done a lot of research, usually read the biographies, read the work itself. And then I think for a while you let that sort of bed in and put everything else to one side. It has to be your novel, your Rupert Brooke, your imagined sort of logic, and that's where I go with it.
Have you ever had anyone say, you know, no, I don't think he would have done that?
Oh yeah, endlessly. And that's everyone else's prerogative too. I mean, there are 11, as far as I know and can think of, biographies on Rupert Brooke, and he's a different man in each. The Lucan story that we're going to be talking about today, there are many, many books on that, but I don't think many which put the victim at the centre of the story as I do. So that's what a novelist wants to find, I suppose, their own way into something.
Yes, we will be talking about the Lord Lucan affair a lot today and your novel, The Language of Birds. But we'll start with your first choice of music now, which is Carole King, Will You Love Me Tomorrow? Why this one?
Well, the novel I've written is set in 1974. This novel was one my sister listened to in the 70s an awful lot, and I really remember it. This song, rather, not a novel at all, this song.
Will You Love Me Tomorrow by Carole King, the first choice of music from our studio guest on Bookmark today, Jill Dawson. Jill has written 10 novels. Fred and Edie, published in 2000, was shortlisted for the Whitbread and Orange Prize. Watch Me Disappear, 6 years later, was longlisted for the Orange Prize. Lucky Bunny won a Fiction Uncovered Award. And The Crime Writer, based on the life of Patricia Highsmith, won the East Anglian Book of the Year. This month sees the publication of The Language of Birds, inspired by the Lord Lucan Beacon case, the Daily Mail described it as timely, devastating and superbly realised. And Grazia said of it, it's both atmospheric and genuinely riveting with a huge feminist heart. Well, I'll come back to that last quote in particular, Jill. But yeah, the novel is just out this month. So for people who haven't read it, what's it about?
Well, it's actually the story of two young women, Mandy and Rosemary, girls from the Fens in the 1970s who want to work in London as nannies and go down to London really to have adventures, the same adventures young men would want, romance, work. But one of them does come to a tragic end. So it's an exploration of a sort of a well-known story, I suppose, from another angle.
And the names are not, it's not Lord Lucan, it's Lord Morven, and you've changed Sandra Rivett to Mandy Rivers. Why did you do that?
Exactly. And in fact, Mandy Rivers is younger. She's 25. She wasn't married as Sandra was. She came from the Fens. You know, I've changed a great deal, actually, about her. Because I think the thing is, if you're using, you know, victims or stories of people who have living descendants, you're really messing with their story. So I wanted this to be, you know, a fictional Mandy and a fictional Rosemary. I think it's a little different when, you know, descendants don't exist or when it's further, longer ago, as other novels I've done have been. This one I had a sensitivity to both families, in fact.
And what was it about the Lord Lucan story that particularly fascinated you? I mean, it's fascinated all of us, really, since it happened.
It's actually, I mean, one of the reasons it fascinates us, I think, is because it does remain unsolved in the sense that because there was never a trial, and it's important to remember that, there was only an inquest. Lord Lucan, you know, we couldn't find out whether he did it or not. He never turned up. He went missing. So it's an unanswered story. But I think what interested me was that for all the sort of, you know, masses of newspaper columns and books about Lucan, the aristocracy, his circle, his gambling friends, the Claremont Club, there was so little about the girl at the centre. And given, I don't want to give too much away, people might remember the story, but given it was an accidental death, I mean, she was murdered, but I don't think she was the intended victim, it seems even more poignant. Somehow that she's so invisible and forgotten. So it was really to do with that.
So what was your starting point when you think you're going to write about this affair? Did you have an image, an idea, a word, a phrase?
Well, funnily enough, usually I start with a place. And on this occasion, I'd gone to King's Lynn for the day, walking around King's Lynn thinking I would set a novel there, because I love King's Lynn and I never have set a novel there. And instead, I simply started thinking about something I'd seen on the news the night before about Lucan. And about his wife, who was still alive at that time, Veronica Lucan, Lady Lucan, who died a year later, a year after I'd started the novel. And so I think I was just, you know, it was just sort of going round in my head, and it was quite random, actually.
And The Language of Birds, it's called. Why that?
Well, I guess I was thinking birds as a 70s word for girls, the language of girls, of women, of young women. But also when you read the novel, of course, one of the nannies does have a rather odd, it doesn't give too much away, I think, to say. She has what we might think of as schizophrenia, perhaps, or she hears voices anyway, and she particularly hears the voices of birds.
And it's called, well, A Huge Feminist Heart, Grazia called it. You must have been pleased with that.
I was, and I mean, I'm glad if people notice the simple politics behind putting the women at the centre of the story. Actually, the Times, interestingly, referred to Lord Morven as the protagonist, which he most certainly isn't. He's quite a peripheral figure around the outside edges of the story. And I think that's very relevant when we tell our stories, you know, who's at the centre and who's a subsidiary character. So as a novelist, I'm slightly irritated by that mistake. It really isn't Lord Morven on this occasion.
Is it hard? Because he had to be quite charismatic and interesting. So he had to be interesting in that sense, but you didn't want him to overshadow Mandy.
Well, I think he, of course, is, you know, intriguing, you know, the ways in which we don't really understand or know why someone would do the sorts of things he did. And certainly in the story, she doesn't know that he's going to, although she doesn't entirely warm to him. It's the other nanny who likes him more. So I was looking at that idea. You know, whenever there's been a murder and people ask the neighbours and they say he was such a quiet man, kept himself to himself. I mean, it's a classic line. I always think, well, that really means you didn't know him. You never saw him enraged. You didn't know what he was capable of. And unless you've had those kind of experiences, you don't know what someone's capable of, it seems to me. So we, you know, I think it's a foolish and pointless remark to make, but people do love to say it every time someone's arrested for a dreadful crime.
And as you say, you were recreating 1970s London. That must have been quite a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. I mean, I went down to London in the 80s, so 10 years later. And, you know, my sister is a little bit older than me, so I was kind of thinking more of her experience of the 70s. But certainly I didn't know London then, so I had loads and loads of books with photographs. That's always the best way, I think. And it's great to see things like what kind of graffiti there was, what kind of... And the two things people were obsessed with back then was Europe, interestingly, because we just were about to... Well, it's 73, we just joined the common market, and terrorism. Although in this occasion it was terrorism, you know, the IRA. But to see that those twin things were very much in the news was interesting to me.
And a time that there were real class distinctions, particularly in London, which you bring out in the novel.
Yeah, and I think much more so, and much more, you know, sort of specific roles for women. It was early feminism, and it was, you know, they had the first women's march in 1971, I think. But it was still a very strange time for young women, with very mixed messages about motherhood, careers, you know, sex in particular, the idea that they could be called birds and that you would get casual sexual harassment, which we now, quite rightly, would be rather shocked by some of, I think.
And it's told from two perspectives, from the perspective of two women. Why did you do that?
Well, I guess if you want to put someone at the centre of a novel and show her world, you can't have the world belong to someone else, if that makes sense. So if I only showed the aristocratic world of Lady and Lord Morven and their circle and their friends, Mandy would always be the outsider. If I give her a friend who belongs to her world, and there's two of them, we have a culture. So I think that's what I was thinking. If you want to show who she is and where she comes from, she's not representative, she's still an individual. So Rosemary's quite different from her, even though they're from the same background.
And they have a kind of psychic link, which is, because obviously 1974, before the age of mobile phones, so that communication was not open to you as a way of connecting the two women.
Yes, that's a fun way of looking at it. A psychic link. I think we were very interested in things like Uri Geller in the 1970s, the possibility of telepathy, the possibility of all sorts of things, you know, that might have been understood by science and perhaps didn't turn out to be true necessarily. But I do remember, for example, playing with Ouija boards at that point in my life. I was a child of about 12 in 1974. And so I sort of also wanted to capture the idea that there was a kind of openness in the thinking about those ideas.
Oh, thank you, Jo. We'll come back and talk to you more about the language of birds. Let's hear about another woman now who's been reclaimed in a novel. Whitney Sharer's debut novel, The Age of Light, is based on the true story of Lee Miller's journey to become a photographer and her love affair with Man Ray in bohemian 1930s Paris. The Boston Globe said it's an absolutely gorgeous feminist novel about art, love and ownership. And Time magazine described it as electric. I met Whitney when she came to Toppin's Bookshop in Ely as part of a whistle-stop tour of the UK, and I asked her if she'd always had an interest in Lee Miller.
I haven't always been interested in her. I actually didn't even know who she was until I went to a museum exhibit of her work and Man Ray's work at a museum north of Boston in 2011. And I went to the exhibit because I love photography and I knew who Man Ray was, but I'd never heard of her. So I walked in and was pretty much just immediately amazed by her talent and kind of frustrated that she wasn't a bigger name in the, you know, at least in the United States as Man Ray is. So that was how I originally found her, and then I started doing all sorts of research and getting to know her better.
And when you decided to write a novel about her, what was your starting point?
First, what I wanted to do was explore the romance between her and Man Ray, just because it was this really, like, interesting time in Lee Miller's life, but it was also this tumultuous and passionate affair where I think they both were making their best art. But the way that I really got into her and the way that I kind of wanted to structure the book was to start at the end of her life, because it doesn't take long in reading about her to find that, you know, she boxed up all of her negatives and photos at the end of her life and just stopped making art. And I found that so sad and compelling, and it felt like start there and then tell the story back to that point again.
And Man Ray and Lee Miller, they're two very strong characters. Was that difficult for you as a writer, balancing the needs of each of those characters so that one doesn't overwhelm the other?
I really wanted to make sure that I didn't write Lee as passive, because she wasn't at all. She was crazy confident and really did whatever it took to get what she wanted. So I was more concerned about making sure that balance was correct between the two of them. And I also feel like with historical fiction, where it's this story of the woman behind the man, oftentimes the woman is seen as reacting to what the man does rather than being an active person. And she was not like that. So that was like my main focus in writing the two characters.
And how much liberty can you take with real facts and with somebody's lives, because you're attributing thoughts to her and actions to her?
Well, you know, you're a fiction writer, so you can take, honestly, as much liberty as you want. However, I wanted to remain true to the facts that I had read about her and do justice to her real story. I started from fact, and then I wanted to be able, in my own mind, to draw a straight line from something I had read to something that I fictionalized in the book, so that I could explain to myself, yes, this is in character with who I think she was.
And what were your sources? I'm guessing, obviously, her photography. What else? Letters?
Not so much letters. More just basically every book that's ever been written about her. So all the biographies. There's some written by her son, and there's another by Carolyn Burke, which is really a fantastic biography. And then books of the period, Man Ray's autobiography, and books about surrealism. You know, it's amazing, actually, how much has been written about the two of them in books about other artists as well.
And did your opinion of her change as you wrote the novel?
You know, I think it did, because when I first encountered her at the museum, I thought she's just incredibly confident, so beautiful, somebody who seems like she's gotten everything she wants out of life. But she had such a traumatic past. When I began to dig into that aspect of her and to realize how much that trauma affected everything she did in her life, that was the thing I think that most surprised me about her.
Yeah, she comes across as a sad figure.
Yeah, I think she was. I mean, I think she had to deal with a lot. You know, she was raped as a child when she was 7, and then her father took nude photographs of her from the age of 8, well into her 20s. And when you think about the horror of that, and then to become a model where you're still being objectified by men in a similar fashion, I mean, it's obviously a huge challenge. And then you layer on top of that, she was one of the first female war correspondents. That was, I think, when she was making the work that she was proudest of, but it was also its own type of trauma layered on top of all the stuff that came before.
And a large part of the novel is set in 1930s Paris and her life amongst the surrealists there. How much fun was that to capture?
Oh, it was the most fun. Because I want to live in that time period, yeah. And I always have. I think so many people are fascinated by that time, just because the interwar period, there was so much creativity in every way just flowering in Paris. And so it's so romantic to think about. And then you have the food, and you have the drinks, and you have just the beauty of the city, and it's just endlessly fascinating.
And I wonder if now that the novel's out there, you sort of have some sort of empathy with Lee Miller more, because in the same way that her photography is out there, is unchangeable, so your novel is the same.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've always had empathy with her, you know, from the beginning. I think I related to her just on the sense of this idea of going on an artistic journey, because I feel like, you know, as a woman writer, I felt like it took me a really long time to own my identity as a writer. And when I think about Lee, I feel like it was the same thing. You know, she really wanted to be an artist, but it was very hard, especially at the time, to have that identity and have people think of her that way rather than just as a muse or an object.
And what kind of person do you think she was in a room, as it were? If she walked into the room now, what kind of impression would she make?
I think she was very confident, and I think she was actually quite funny. I don't think she comes across as funny in my book as she maybe was in real life. I think she told a lot of body jokes. I think in a room where she was comfortable with the other people who were there, I think she might be the life of the party, whereas I think if it was strangers, she might keep a little distance between herself and them around her.
And you're here in the UK on a whistle-stop tour, really. How are you finding it?
Oh, it's been so fun. The bookstores here are so lovely, and I've been, I think, taken to the creme de la creme. I mean, I'm sure they're all amazing, but just so cozy, and everybody has been really warm and inviting. And it's been really fun because Lee isn't quite as much of a name in the United States, it's been really fun to do events here, and people have very strong opinions about the type of woman she was and the things that they've read about her, and so that's been fun to have those conversations.
And somebody was telling me the cover for the book here in the UK is quite different to the one in the States.
Yeah, it's vastly different. This one has kind of an Art Deco feel and just very elegant. I love it. And the US one, it also has an Art Deco flavor. It definitely is of the period, but it's red and white and it's much more punchy, whereas this, I think, is more elegant.
And what's next for you?
I'm working on another project of historical fiction, and it's also based on a real woman's life, but it's very different time period. It's set in the late 1800s in Colorado during the Silver Rush.
And is that your genre now, do you think?
I think for the foreseeable future, yeah. You know, when I found this story and started writing something that was based on fact, I just felt like, oh, this is my wheelhouse. I know how to do this. And when I'm thinking of an entire plot by myself, I tend to just go down these rabbit holes and not really know how to get myself out of them.
And how easy has it been to let Lee go?
I haven't really felt like I'm letting her go yet, which is very nice.
Well, must be odd because you've got your head in two women at the moment, then.
Yeah, that's true. Although, to be honest, I was doing some writing last year before the book came out. But right now, as I'm traveling around, I'm doing a lot of touring. I'm going to go back to the States. I'm touring for about 3 more months. So I'm not actually having that much time to write. I'm really just doing a lot of research. So I haven't let go of Lee yet.
And The Age of Light by Whitney Shara is published by Picador. Listening to that with me on Bookmark today was Jill Dawson, here to talk about her novel, The Language of Birds, based on the Lord Lucan affair. Well, I might ask you a question that I asked Whitney, really, which is about empathy and empathising with your character. Did you identify with Mandy, the character at the centre of your story? Because you worked as a nanny, didn't you?
I did, yes. I think you have to, but I think you spread your empathy, if you like, between characters. So I also identified quite a lot with Rosemary. So Rosemary and Mandy were opportunities to explore the feelings about looking after children who aren't your own, which I've done. The feelings about motherhood, you know, one of them wants to be a mother and chooses to be a mother, let's say. I won't give too much away. And one of them, I think, actually doesn't, although she's not quite admitting that to herself. And given that it was a time when women might well have been questioning those choices because of free contraception or becoming available, I found it really interesting to look at my own decisions. I had a child at 27, so and then another one at nearly 40, and then adopted a third at 50. So obviously I've been very interested in motherhood, but I haven't written much about it.
And in terms of research, you were, because the book covers quite a lot of areas, you touch on mental health as well as 1970s London, as well as the actual ins and outs of the Lord Lucan affair. How big was your pile of research books?
Well, I always do masses of research. And then, as I think all novelists sort of know, you also have to put it aside. So, yeah, I did end up reading on all those topics. And the study is just bursting with books. But I don't know. I try and do it with a light touch. I don't want to wedge that in. It becomes just part of something to be thinking about, you know, for example, in terms of the mental health, you know, the R.D. Lang movements to kind of have more radical approaches to mental health would be part of my reading, but it's quite a small part of the novel in the end.
Is the idea that you kind of absorb it and then it bubbles up in the characters and the story?
Yes, I think you have to absorb it and make it somehow your own, you know, almost to have forgotten the details but have taken the essence. And there's something about the spirit of what you're reading that becomes important in terms of research.
Well, let's hear your second choice of music now, which is People Get Ready by Eva Cassidy, which features in the book, doesn't it?
It does. I think it's a very, very sad, melancholic song. And so we have this at the funeral scene in the novel.
There's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to Odysseus a humming. You don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord, yeah.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations,
And our guest on Bookmark today is Jill Dawson, talking about her new novel, The Language of Birds, based on the Lord Lucan affair. Jill, we were saying earlier, it's written from two perspectives, really, isn't it? One is the first person, one's third person, but it's Mandy's perspective, really. How did you write it? Did you alternate between those two, or did you write one and then go back and write the other?
I think if I remember rightly, I began with Mandy's perspective, and I began with her arriving in London. And the novel was very much going to be simply in that form. And then, as so often happens with me, once I start actually writing, you know, on a regular basis, someone else's voice will come in. And the Rosemary voice, which was quite an odd one and troubled me, I kept thinking, who's this? You know, is it another side to Mandy? So I began to understand I needed to have this second girl for the reasons I've said, for the idea that this was Mandy's world and Mandy's culture. And to give you the kind of contrast between the Fens and London, because Mandy is a modern figure who sort of embraces it, and Rosemary really isn't. She's almost from another era, and I think that's often what a rural place is like. So I didn't alternate it. I wrote it all in big chunks and then kind of cut it up. That's often how I work. And one of the things to say, just because we just listened to a lovely piece of music there with this beautiful, beautiful singing of Eva Cassidy, is I often listen to music when I'm working, nearly always. And so I would have different sort of songs for the different characters to get myself quickly in the mood, or this is Mandy's song, this is Mandy's voice, you know, and this is Rosemary's. And that's something that I find music has that effect on me very easily.
And I'm interested that Rosemary's voice came in there. When you say you heard it, how does that work?
Well, you know, I mean, the novel is obviously about hearing voices. And I did end up doing a lot of research about that concept, because that is how I experience writing. And I'm sure I'm not alone. Many novelists do say this, don't they? They get kind of possessed by the voice they're hearing in their head and want to reproduce it on the page. So that's what kept happening to me, is there would be a quirky person making slightly odd, rather religious remarks. And I would sort of think, well, that doesn't seem to fit with Mandy. And so I started to put it together in a second separate document. And that's how a voice... I mean, it happened with the Rupert Brooke novel. I had intended, I think, to write it almost entirely from Nell's point of view, one of the characters. And then because I was reading Rupert Brooke and his poetry all the time, I started to hear his voice more clearly. And so a second strand came in.
And you mentioned the Fens there. The Fens do feature in a lot of your novels.
Yes.
You do like the Fens, don't you?
I do. It's funny. I mean, I didn't grow up there. It's all new to me, the Fens. I've been there nearly 20 years now, so not so new, perhaps. But what I mean is I've studied a lot and thought a lot about the Fens. And something about that landscape, I think, is just brilliantly productive for a novelist. And it's so empty and open. So the idea that it's a big space, really, that you want to fill with imagination and sort of... And also, I'm very interested in the idea of how people's environment affects them. So people who come from the Fens, as Mandy and Rosemary do, you know, how will that continue to have an impact on them in their lives in London?
And was that where you started with the character of Mandy, the Fens?
I think so, because also I was thinking of myself coming to London as a nanny, and I was from Yorkshire, so also from a rural place, and the sorts of culture shock I had about things like supper being at 10 o'clock when I would want my tea at 5:30, I think it's the kinds of things Mandy also experiences. And the sort of, you know, rather terrifying feeling of being dropped into a family, into a very intimate family life, and the family might be in conflict. There might be an affair or a drama going on. And the nanny lives at home, obviously, and is absorbing all the emotion in the house. And her job is to sort of often shield and shelter the children from it, which I think is a very intriguing premise.
And how much did you base it on what we know of the story? I was going to say the truth, but nobody really knows the truth. What we know of the story.
Towards the end of the novel, there are actually some very accurate, you know, there's a bit from the inquest, to be honest, that's word for word without me changing it, so that people could hear for themselves the particular account, really, that Lady Lucan gave, for example, which I've always found completely convincing and compelling. And I think in this Me Too climate, many others would too. There doesn't seem to me to be much reason to suspect her of making it up, beating herself up, you know, causing herself the injuries, or lying. I just find that rather in a way shocking that people have chosen not to believe her account. So in a way, I did leave that in so that the reader would be aware of it. But there's plenty of departures. And since nobody does know what happened to Luke, and I think there's room there for another, you know, for imagination again.
And you feel comfortable in that space?
Well, I think I was listening to your, you know, the extract just then about the idea of a line between research and fact and a novel. And I think for me, this concept of the logic of emotion or the logic of imagination being just as valid. I think if you spend a lot of time thinking about a story, you do start to have a feeling which feels true. And that's what we have to go with. And I don't think it's illegitimate, if you like. I think it's a completely legitimate art form.
And have you had any contact with any of the descendants of people involved in the case?
No, but I'm pretty sure I will do, because immediately I spoke about it at a bookshop. Two people came up to me who had connections. One had had her mother had been the nanny to Veronica Lucan. Wow. She was dead now, but anyway, long ago she had been. And someone else in the audience had, I think it was an uncle who'd been one of the first policemen on the scene. So I feel that once a novel is out there, that's what happens. That's when you get people kind of telling you their stories or connections. But in a funny way, when writing the novel, I think you are trying to find your own way through. So they're not always that helpful to the path you're trying to sort of find.
And does the house still exist where the murder took place? Were you able to go and visit that?
No, I didn't visit it. It does still exist. But in a way, I stepped away from that and decided, again, that was a detail too close. I mean, I didn't put the same children in the house. That felt very wrong. You know, there was actually three children. And in my novel, there's only two. They're different ages. They're different genders. You know, I did feel a great responsibility to the story, but that's frustrating when you also feel that the narrative that we are told all the time, that in a way perpetrators of violence, the devil has the best tunes. If you want to attack and challenge that, then sort of working my way through those constraints really is what I'm about.
Well, the domestic violence side of Lord Lucan's character will be news to a lot of people. It's news to me. I didn't know about that because all the talk is about his disappearance.
Exactly. And also because the only account we have, again, is Veronica Lucan's, and it was disputed. So that's the difficulty, you see. I mean, the simple fact is he did arrange to have his children snatched. They were in a custody battle. It's absolutely on record that he had private detectives, that the house was in effect stalked by him and by his detectives. But stalking wasn't a crime in 1974. So, you know, many people were very understanding of that. Oh, he wants his children back. Why shouldn't he? So our attitudes to such things have shifted. And she does have at least one previous description of the sexual beatings, which are in the novel, are absolutely accurate, and of one further attack that was a sort of, you know, pushing down some stairs. So again, if you take her account, then there's a very clear record, as there usually is in cases when a murder's committed by a husband and ex. You know, there's usually a pattern of violence there.
Thank you, Jill. We'll come back to you in a moment. We'll take a break now to hear from Kay Blaney. Kay's a teacher and a writer. The Mill Road Monologues are a series of imagined speeches from past residents of Mill Road in Cambridge, arguably the city's most vibrant area. I asked Kay to tell me a little more about the monologues and how they came to be.
The Mill Road Monologues started when I was teaching drama at Parkside. I was always very keen about taking my students to the Mill Road Cemetery because I'd written a scheme of work called Conflict and War Then and Now, which was based on World War One and Afghanistan. And obviously the Mill Road Cemetery was this great resource with some World War One graves. Just stepping back before that, I did a piece called Graveside Monologues with some students from Parkside, Coleridge, Chesterton and Manor, North Cambridge Academy now. And that's where friends of the Mill Road Cemetery had seen my work and were very interested in getting me involved more in the cemetery creative writing side of things. Between my teaching work and meeting the Mill Road, Friends of the Mill Road Cemetery, a really lovely, great partnership and collaboration was born out of that. I did a Victorian day. They asked me to write some monologues from certain people that were in the graves, and they're not World War One. They're in the monologue book. And students always performed my work rather than me. So that was just great. And then obviously getting students involved in the writing as well. And then I was asked to do the World War One for the centenary of World War One, the beginning of that was in 2014. And that's how the World War One monologues derived.
You've always been interested in life writing, then?
Very much so.
What is
yeah.
it about life writing that you...
Because they're real people's lives. I like the non-fiction side of things, but I put a bit of a creative license on some of that, because often people I write about were certainly buried. I've just finished my master's in education. My methodology was life stories, which I learned masses about the ethics of that. So obviously, even if you're writing about somebody that has died, you've still got family members to consider. So that's been a great thing to know that side of the work as well as the creative side.
Yes, I mean, how much poetic license do you take? Because these were real people.
You know, in some ways, always to their advantage, just the things that may have been in their heads, the thought tracks, all of the research has been there. That's what's the joy for me. The Mill Road History Group and the people that do the research for the Mill Road graves, all of this wonderful history, they're quite bullet pointed in some points, and then anecdotes and stories where they lived. And then I would just add some life things onto that. For instance, emotions between a mother and a son, emotions between husband and wife, and loss. So those things that if you know and have empathy with, that's where the creative license comes.
And it's Mill Road monologues. So are there things in the monologues specific to Mill Road?
Yes, with the cemetery side of things, and then landmarks. And then the Leah Manning, I wrote a monologue about Leah Manning because she was one of the first women city councillors that was really, really behind the Labour Club being built and there at the opening. And in actual fact, when I went to Homerton College just recently, I noticed that there was a Leah Manning room. So, you know, one of those women, especially us, with us celebrating the 100 years of the suffragettes this year, there was all of those women pre the suffragettes that were part of the National Women's Union Workers, and Leah Manning, Molly Blair was another one of those women, and Eglantine Jebb. There's so many more to write. There needs to be Mill Road monologues too, I think.
And you brought it right up to date because there's a tribute to Susie Oakes, who people around Mill Road will know was quite a figure, local figure.
Yeah, Susie, again, who I met that very first time, she was with Caro Wilson, who's very involved in Mill Road. And they were friends, and they came to the graveside monologues. And that's when Susie got me involved in helping to organise the Mill Road Winter Fair.
They're monologues, so they're written for performance.
Yes.
So when you're writing for performance, what particular skills are you using?
I try and always put something to grab people in with. Often I use music and songs that would be of the period or of the time, or that are something to do with what the character or the landmark is about, just to draw the audience in. So for instance, there's an Emma Rolfe. She is buried in Mill Road Cemetery, and she was murdered on Midsummer Common, and her family are buried. It's a family grave. Her younger stories involved in some of the research, and so automatically I wanted to start with Ring a Ring of Roses, juxtaposing the innocence with the not so innocent.
There's some fascinating stories there then.
Yeah, and real, you know, these things happened and they're in the news. There's one I've just written recently, is about the Earl of Derby, and that was about two of the landlords, actually.
So it's a pub.
Yeah, a pub on Mill Road. Yeah, there's so much. It's such a rich in information and history road, as are many. You know, we could probably have the Cherrington Road monologues and the Town and Gown monologues. Monologues have always fascinated me.
And with a monologue, you're not just telling a story, are you? You've got to make sure you reveal character as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, you have. There's got to be other voices in there, and to bring those voices out, and that's a real nice of a roller coaster of emotions. And so from a performance side of you, that's quite nice for the actor as well, that they can portray these different characters with some different voices. My writing really gives the performer lots of creative license.
And was this a collaborative project?
Collaborative in the sense that the history group wanted this work that I'd done with them, and the Mill Road Friends of the Cemetery wanted me to do the work for their events, as it were. And then it was a thank you from them to me to publish the books in this Capturing Cambridge, which was all part of the Heritage Lottery bid back in the day when they got that bid. So this was something as a celebration at the end. And then obviously I'm taking the book forward. Some of the money's gone, the proceeds have gone back into the cemetery and back into the history group, and some of which now is going to go back into perhaps getting the rest of the monologue series of Mill Road 1, 2, 3, well, we've got 1, 2, 3 and 4.
So, do you want to read an extract for
us? As I'm a teacher, I think it's I'll put on my teacher voice and I'll do Emma Hosegood, who was the matron of what was the Cambridge Workhouse, which was then the maternity hospital on Mill Road and now, as everybody knows it, Ditchburn Place. Come along, girls, hurry along, it's arithmetic time. Once 12 is 12, two 12s are 24, three 12s are 36. 36. Just a number, you may well think. But 36 is the amount of years that my dear husband Luke and I served in the Cambridge Workhouse on Mill Road. Master Hosegood, that's my husband, was in charge of the boys, and I, Mrs. Hosegood, was in charge of the girls, and between us we worked very hard. Working with the young and elderly, variety was definitely the spice of life, and we loved it. Keeping house and teaching. Oh, think what you may, but it's more than a job. It's a vocation. It's life-changing. It's a calling. I can assure you that we were dedicated to our roles, and may I say, honoured to be at the forefront of educating the youngsters at the workhouse. We were trusted back then. Trusted to simply get on with it, our jobs. And it wasn't just the youngsters that we worked with back then. Oh no, it was all ages. My Luke was outstanding. He could turn his hand to any age group. I remember that April day back in 1883 when he was the hero of the day. Fire, fire, there's a fire in the infirmary. Quick, hurry up, help. I can see my Luke now. He had determination in his eyes as he plunged himself back into the flames, rescuing the elderly inmates. I was so proud of Luke. And do you know what? I think he was proud of me too. All in a day's work, my friends. All in a day's work.
And that was an edited version of the monologue at the end. To read the full version and the other monologues, get a copy of the Mill Road Monologues by Kay Blaney from either the Capturing Cambridge website or by emailing Kay herself, kay@kayblaney.co.uk. On Bookmark today, we've been talking to Jill Dawson about her new novel, The Language of Birds. What's next for you now, Jill, after this?
Well, I'm in a phase where I'm starting to dream up another novel. I can feel a couple vying for my attention, and I'm trying to see which of them it's going to be. So I don't know much more than that right now.
How does that start? Do you just have an idea, or something comes from the back of your mind to the front?
It's kind of exactly that. And it might well be an idea I've had ages ago. You know, I said I went to King's Lynn and there was something I wanted to write about there. And I'm wondering if it's now timely for that one. You know, it's something about timing occasionally. But I have to sort of work it through my mind quite a lot before beginning, because I know that once I begin, I'm quite intense when I work. So I'm sort of committed. And as you know you know how I work, but it comes out quite quickly. But I do a lot of sort of just drifting and dreaming until I get that feeling.
Do you allow yourself a period of rest and congratulations?
Yes, I completely have at least a year off. And in fact, between this book, I've had over 18 months now where I haven't written anything. So I have been waiting to see what was going to grab me next. And because I'm quite productive, people are always surprised by that. I have an absolute break. It's almost like emptying myself out. And it might well be why another thing that's said about me is that the novels are very different from one another, you know, different sort of voices, time periods, forms. I think that's what happens. It's not as if it's the same novel being written in many different ways, which I think is the case with some writers. It's something quite distinct.
Are your fingers not twitching to start to write something?
I can feel it now, they are. But they haven't been. I've been enjoying a sort of... I've been enjoying working with my students and just having a sort of feeling of... just not quite emptiness, but openness, I think, is a better way of saying it.
And you mentioned your students there. You do keep yourself busy. You've got the Gold Dust scheme. Tell us about that.
Well, so Gold Dust Mentoring pairs established writers with emerging or beginner writers or those who want to work intensively on a manuscript over a year. And I mentor, I don't teach anymore. I have taught at UEA and various other places. But I mentor the writers whose work I've chosen. Not necessarily the same kinds of things I do. Some are historical, some might be factual, but actually I mentor a real range and work with the student over a year. And we have many success stories, as you know, and we have many mentors who work for us. So, you know, plenty of local ones, Jim Kelly, Sally Klein, Midge Gillies, Michelle Spring, and then Louise Doughty, Andrew Miller, etc., etc. So it's not just myself. There's about 18 mentors.
And the difference between that and an MAA is the kind of one-to-one attention.
It is. And the sense in which people finish their work, which you don't always do on an MAA, you know, you complete a whole novel under our scheme or a biography or whatever it is you're working on. And I think that's the intensity, the one-to-one, and the sense in which there's time to complete a manuscript is what's sort of unique about Gold Dust.
So if people want to find out more about that, you've got a website?
I have indeed. Golddust.org.uk. I think that's right. It's a long time since I've had to say that. Anyway, Gold Dust Mentoring, I'm pretty sure if you Google that, you'd find it.
And the question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark is, what are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading the short story writer Lucia Berlin, American writer. Don't know if listeners will know her. Highly recommended. Just read a story called The Wives. It's very sort of sexy, very atmospheric. She's compared to Raymond Carver, you know, it's that sort of writing. It's just wonderful.
And of course, you used to write short stories.
Yes, and I do still, just occasionally. I did start off writing short stories and poetry, and I've won a few short story competitions. It's a form I like, but I think it's very challenging.
You don't think you'll go back to it, do you?
I haven't had the urge to write a story for a long time. It comes to me now as a much more extended, you know, a novel, basically.
Thank you, Jill. We'll come back to you in a moment for your last choice of music. But we've been talking today about The Language of Birds by Jill Dawson, which is published by Scepter. A heads up that our next show studio guest is Penny Hancock, talking about her new novel, I Thought I Knew You. We'll also hear from Joshua Winning, author of the Sentinel trilogy. And stand-up comedian and blogger Sam Avery will be chatting about his first book, Confessions of a Learner Parent. You can find all the older episodes of Bookmark on the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.co.uk. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Jill, which is Aretha Franklin and You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. Why this one?
I think it takes courage and daring to really feel, especially if you've been hurt. And Mandy has courage, the protagonist of my novel, and that's why I love this song. And it's the Queen.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired. And when I knew I had to face another day, Lord, it made me feel so tired. So unkind, and you're the key to my.
Cambridge 105 Radio.